Hello everyone, I'm Harry Bucknell. Thank you for downloading this podcast from ABF, the Soldiers' Charity, recorded before the final withdrawal from Afghanistan at the end of August. Born in India, General Sir Michael Rose's stepfather was the prolific author and former Chindit, John Masters. After schooling at Cheltenham, he studied at Oxford and the Sorbonne in Paris, before interview by the War Office Selection Board, to whom he remarked that his family, who had soldiered for the East India Company over many centuries, regarded the British Army as a collection of poodle fakers. Bypassing Sandhurst altogether, he was commissioned into the Coldstream Guards in 1959, joining an army which even then was 240,000 strong and still straddled the world. After 38 years' service, during which he was mentioned in dispatches, awarded the Queen's Gallantry Medal and decorated with the Distinguished Service Order. He commanded 22 SAS during the Iranian Embassy siege and the Falklands War, 39 Brigade in Northern Ireland, the 2nd Infantry Division in York, the Army Staff College at Camberley, and the United Nations Protection Force in Croatia, Bosnia and Herzegovina at the height of the Yugoslav Wars. He retired as Adjutant General in 1997 and for 10 years was Colonel of the Coldstream Guards. Since he has spoken out prolifically on the failures of the Iraq War, Afghanistan, and the legacy of the Troubles. Plain speaking, clear thinking, and swift of foot from the very outset, little about General Mike's career can be described as conventional. Our conversation starts with the man of his joining. I hope you enjoy the programme.
We'll start off with the manner of your joining the army, because you came from the Sorbonne, you joined the Gloucesters, and then the Rifle Brigade, and then the RAF, and then finally made your mind up about the Coldstream. That's quite a roundabout route.
It sounds slightly unusual, but I guess it was at the time. Nowadays, I'm sure people with far more varied backgrounds are joining the army. But I come from a long line of soldiers, all of whom were in either the East India Company or in serving in the British Indian Army. And so I was determined not to join that line of soldiers, particularly as the British Empire had come to an end. And at school, I joined the local TA regiment, because we all discovered at age 16, and of course CCF was compulsory in those days, that at the age of 16, if you join the local TA regiment, you got 10 shillings for a Wednesday afternoon and a pound a day for field, being in the field over the summer camp. And that was an enormous sum of money. So we all decamped from the CCF at Cheltenham College and joined the local Gloucestershire Regiment. So that's how I started off as a private soldier in the TA Gloucester Regiment, where I kind of kept the motion going as I was going off to university and joined the City of London Yeomanry, the Rough Riders. It wasn't actually the Rifle Brigade, but it was administered by them. It was a wonderful regiment. There were 40 officers and 40 other ranks. And basically, it was a very good dining club. But we did do a very good exercise during my time up in Pembrokeshire, where I was the platoon commander of the Vickers machine gun platoon, which was great fun. Then when I went to university, as a matter of devilment, really, I joined the Royal Air Force because I wanted to learn to fly. And you could fly for nothing without telling them I was actually in the TA. So I kept the two motions going at the same time. And then when I left university, I was kind of unemployed. I was doing a lot of skiing and sailing, and an extremely charming old boy I used to crew for said, "Come on, Mike, you really ought to get a job." And I fixed that for you to go and have an interview with the Army Board. So I went off to the War Office for their selection board, and they asked me about my background. And they said, I said, "Well, we've always regarded my family have always regarded the British Army as a collection of poodle fakers," which was an old Indian Army expression for the British Army. And the chap was very long-suffering. He said, "Well, you must have some connection to the British Army." I said, "Well, I have an uncle and a cousin who's in the Coldstream." So he called the Coldstream Guards, and by chance, they had lost an officer on exercise of my age, 24, in Germany, when a ferret scout card rolled on him. And so the Coldstream, very generously, took me on as a sort of TA commission, a regular officer, which is what I did. I never went to Sandhurst. Fortunately, the commanding officer, Alan Pemberton, and the adjutant, John Pilley, both of whom had been at Oxford, understood the slightly curious ways of Oxford undergraduates and warned the sergeant's mess they were having this unusual kind of entry. And from that moment, I never looked back.
You're, of course, you were born in India, Your stepfather was the legendary John Masters, the novelist and Chindit. What influence did he have on your upbringing and your interest in the army?
Well, I think it was a bit of a surprise to him that I joined the army. He and I were a very good friend. For example, when I became brigade major of 16 Parachute Brigade, he'd been brigade major of a brigade, the Chindit Brigade, the 77 Brigade, and I asked him what tips he had for being a brigade major. And he gave me a long and distant look and said, I was a brigade major in wartime. I have nothing to offer for a peacetime soldier. And he was full of teasing and amusement like that. He was an extraordinarily curious mind. He knew about pretty well everything, which has made him, what made him a very good writer.
We talk about global Britain and interviewing the chief of the General Staff, General Sir Mark Carleton Smith, last month for General Talk. He discussed about the entrepreneurial spirit that needs to come back into the army of today. It being much smaller, how do you think we engender that entrepreneurial spirit, which people like Old Wingate, who led the Chindits, had in spades?
It's going to be extremely difficult because the army that you and I belong to, I think, is very different from the army of today. The army today is much smaller. It's far more under the political microscope. Everything has to be approved by the upper management. Whereas in our day, we had far more latitude to develop, as you say, the entrepreneurial spirit. So I think unless some kind of policy decision is taken to allow people to make mistakes, to try out new ideas and new things without necessarily okaying it beforehand with the politicians and with the senior officers, then I think we're not ever going to be able to do that. And I think that's a great shame. And it doesn't actually bring about war-winning psychologies. I mean, Lord Esher, at the end of the South African wars, was asked to commission a report into the failings of the British Army at the time. And in the end, I think he summed it up in a line, which I often quote, saying, "The minds brought up to attend to a minutiae of administrative detail can scarcely be expected to take bold decisions in time of war." And I fear we may be drifting down that line ourselves today, and that we need to let the brakes off young officers and young non-commissioned officers and indeed soldiers, to let them experiment and try and sometimes make mistakes, because that's the only way we'll ever learn and keep ourselves abreast of what's required for a modern war.
Do you think that in this all-embracing, all-encompassing, highly bureaucratic armed forces of today, where it seems to be it is form filling upon form filling, do you think that in overplaying perhaps the sense of the duty of care, the army has become over politically woke, worrying about transgender issues and diversity rather than war fighting?
Well, I'd rather stay away from the word woke, because of course it means so many different things to so many different people. I think it's actually lost its meaning. It's become a kind of a political weapon to wave at people. I think you're absolutely right that the reluctance for the senior officers to take risk and the passing of that reluctance down to every level in the army is actually, again, doesn't make for a war-winning psychology. In your day and my day, we'd be able to go on the range, set up our own live firing practices, and indeed sometimes a corporal would be out there doing that today. There is the health and safety aspects governing practically everything. And there are vast volumes being written about how to run a range practice, whereas in our day it was common sense that allowed you. And if you separate risk from the tactical training, which is what really has happened, then I don't think, again, you're going to be very good at war fighting, because of course risk, management of risk, is actually a function of tactics. It's not saying that you should be handing on to somebody different. And if you hand it on to an agency or another structure, then of course you're, and particularly on the legal side, I mean, that's also true, you're never going to be able to take bold decisions in time of war. Always be looking over your back.
You, of course, had a somewhat legendary career with the Special Air Service. What was the attraction that took you away to the hills of Hereford?
Well, it was quite simple. I was an instructor at the Guards Depot 13 Company. My company commander was Peter Gibbs, and there were no recruits, so we were sitting there twiddling our fingers. And I said to Peter, I think I'm going to go and try something else for a while. And I went off to do the Foreign Office exam. Well, having got through to the final interview board, we discussed my characteristics with the final interview board, and we both decided that there's no way that I would ever make a diplomat. So off I went back to Peter Gibbs and said, well, the Foreign Office don't want me. And he said, well, I'll tell you what, while we're looking for another job, he'd actually arranged for me to be second commander of the parachute, the Independent Guards Parachute Company. He said, well, but that job's gone. You go down to G Squadron, which is being formed in Hereford. And like all other officers, we'll be back in 2 weeks. And in 2 weeks' time, you'll be, we'll have found another job for you, because my time would come up at the end of 13 company tour of duty. So off I went to Hereford. Very ill prepared, I have to say. And of course, I never really came back.
What was the sort of great difference between being with the Special Air Service and serving with the regular army?
The young troop commanders in there were ready on sufferance. The troops didn't really want them around. They were sort of got in the way. They knew what to do better than any troop commander possibly could. But they realized at the end of the day, they had to have an officer corps to run them. And so they sort of suffered the young troop commander for his 3 years, taught him as much as they could, hoping that he'd come back or not. As a squadron commander, he'd be able to sort of make a contribution. I think that's really, it was a learning curve when I was a troop commander. Actually, Johnny Watts, commanding officer at the time, discovered I'd done some free fall parachuting while I was at Oxford University. And because the ASS didn't have a free fall capability, he sent me off to RAF Abingdon for 1 year. And it was there that we developed the high altitude capability for free fall parachuting, which they still use today. But as a result of some of the work we did by putting automatic openers on all parachutists, et cetera, when you're coming out from 25,000 feet and the temperature is -60 with the wind chill factor, you get an awful lot of icing and you get very difficult to read your altimeter. So some people were losing their orientation, some people not aiming their parachute, et cetera, and were killing themselves. So by putting automatic openers, I'm just giving one example, we were able to solve that particular problem. And when I look at this free fall people today, they really are using, other than they've got square parachutes rather than round, which are actually much safer. That was probably the highlight of that time, particularly as we were, whilst I was there, the SS were ordered to take the Musandam Peninsula in northern Oman. And the only way into the Musandam is by high altitude free fall parachute. So we put together a group of guys from the SS, and so we actually put into operational use all the stuff that we'd been developing and practicing for the last year. So that was probably the highlight.
Of course, the highlight of your time with the Special Air Service was when you were commanding the regiment in Hereford. It was a slightly golden era, really, because it put the SAS on the map in a big way. First of all, with Operation Nimrod in May 1980, Iranian Arabs who were promoting the independence of Kurdistan took the Iranian embassy. What was your initial reaction when you heard about the hostage siege on the news?
Well, I didn't hear it on the news at all. The way things work is never the way they're meant to work. What happened, we were a bit busy preparing for an exercise called an Aglo exercise up in the northeast of England. And that is an exercise which is sprung on the Foreign Office, the government, the military, the police, to test their counter-terrorist capabilities. So we were in the middle of a whole series of signals being sent, preparing us to deploy up to Newcastle. The colour sergeant, the officer next, called me over and said, somebody desperately wants to talk to you. So I said, who is it? And he said, hey, boss, it's Dusty Gray. I said, where are you? Nice to talk to you, Dusty. You know, how things are in the Met these days. He left the army to be on shore in the Met voluntarily. Turned out he was a dog handler in the cordon that was around the Iranian embassy. He said, you better get yourself down here, boss. They ain't going to be able to handle this one, the police. They're not going to be able to do it right. Get yourself down. So I immediately rang the Ministry of Defence, who were responsible for this exercise at Glen, and said, right, I'm abandoning the exercise. I'm heading down the motorway as we speak. He said, I was given the order not to do that, which, of course, I completely ignored. I deployed a squadron. I then got in a helicopter with Jeremy Fitz, my ops officer, and we flew down. The Ministry of Defence discovered we were inbound through the air traffic control system and grounded at us at North Holt. Well, at North Holt, by chance, there was another counter-terrorist exercise, an RAF lockdown exercise that was in play. And so the arrival of an unexpected helicopter with two people dressed in civilian clothes banging on the door of the control tower, which was their operational center, they thought was part of the exercise, even more so when Jeremy Phipps' coat fell open and a pistol appeared in his belt. We thought, why he was carrying a pistol? I have absolutely no idea at all. And so that set us back another 20 minutes. In the end, we managed to persuade them that it was a no-doubt by a real issue we were involved in. And they lent us the staff commander's car, the commanding officer's staff car. And we shot the young 18-year-old, never had a drive in his life like it before or since. We jumped every traffic light and shot through the horse guards and across into the Ministry of Defence, whereupon I was told to get myself straight down to the Ministry of Defence, where, of course, I finally caught up with Dusty and said to him, right, and I got the best briefing for the entire Iranian embassy siege from him. During the Iranian embassy siege, there were three levels of command, which is all there should be. Strategic, that was Cobra.
Yeah.
Willie Whitelaw, MC, Second World War, Scots Guards, great. He ran it. Thatcher delegated it to him and then walked away and didn't touch it again. She got the rules out at the start and then handed it over to him, moved on, went on to do whatever she does. Then you had the operational level. That was three people only. That was John Dello, who was the assistant chief commissioner, who was nominated by the Hammer McNee of the Yard from Glasgow, proper policeman, old-fashioned policeman.
Yeah.
Been put in there to sort out corruption in the Met. Hammer McNee, but he didn't play. He only came and visited once or twice. But John Dello, very, very bright guy, was in charge. Then you had Hayden Phillips, who was the civil servant from the Home Office. He was the second one in there. And then there was me, the military voice. And we're in an office by this size. And the people kept coming in, coffeehousing, and they kept saying, how can we keep people out? Can you have a guard on the door? I said, no, don't do that. I said, much easier. We'll just have three chairs, no table and no coffee. And so we threw all the chairs out, no table, so people would be able to look, come in, see us talking in a far corner of the room, right, with three chairs. And they'd say, oh, everything okay? Yes, thanks, now bugger off. So we kept, you know, that's how we ran it. And then, of course, at the tactical level, you had, and that's where all the input came in. And at the tactical level, you had Hector Gallanis and the policemen on the ground, the negotiators and all that, following the instructions that we were setting at that. And never once did one side try to overrule or demand detail, too much detail from below. And at one point I visited the Cobra, and the permanent undersecretary said, suddenly popped up in the middle of a discussion, said, I think the SS should notice the move should be reduced from, you know, 1 or 2 hours, whatever it was, down to 15 minutes. So that completely knackered all our preparations and training that we were doing. Willie Whitelaw sort of beetled his eyebrows and looked at his permanent undersecretary and said, I don't think that's a subject for the permanent undersecretary. I think that's a subject for the commanding officer of the 22nd Special Air Service, who we're lucky enough, I see, to have in the room at the moment. Michael, what do you think? I said, certainly not. He said exactly what I'd have said. And that was it. We just carried on. So that was typical, you know, that was properly run.
Yeah.
And now there are so many levels of command involved that it's much more difficult to get quick, timely decision. I mean, when I was in Bosnia, I was actually summoned to the telephone by President Clinton. I refused to take the call. I said, tell him I'm out, because there was no way, if I'd spoken to Clinton, I'd have said something which would have completely destroyed the relationship that I had with the United Nations headquarters in New York, with Zagreb, which was the intermediate headquarters, because Clinton would have taken something I had said and run with it, and that would have completely broken down my way, using the proper chain of command. So I rang back about an hour later and said, I'm sorry I couldn't take the president's call. What did he want? And he said, oh, he wanted to wish you happy Christmas. I said, thank you very much. Will you please wish him happy Christmas? I knew bloody well he wanted to talk about some incident. But That I think is much better than having the president or the prime minister looking at the head cams of the people on the ground. Terrible for the young people at the front line. And one of the disciplines we should be teaching politicians is not to get involved. The guys on the ground do what they know how to do best, because they certainly do know better than the politician. But going back to a more important point, I mean, the Iranian embassy siege, I think, did no favours to the SAS in the long run, because it brought us out of the shadows into public awareness and recognition. And the SAS up to then had always been unrecognized, having to steal, lie, use all the weapons of war in order to survive. And that was a good psychology. After that, things started to be given to them. and life became, and of course, it's a much better, the previous mindset is better for war fighting than being a recognized, much funded organization as it is today. Not that the guys today are any worse. In fact, they're far better, I'm sure, than the people we were working with. But we just had a completely different mindset than today. And I don't think all this publicity that came from the Iranian embassy actually was very good for the SAS in the long run.
Am I right in thinking that you jumped ship in the Falklands War and actually refused to hand over command until such time as you'd got down south?
Well, it was quite a complicated system. It was quite complicated. My line of command at that time, as a Kwani officer, 22 SAS, went from me directly, operationally, to the Director of Military Operations, who stayed well clear of us. He didn't want to really get involved. And so Peter de Billy, who was the Director SAS, as it was then called, he was responsible for what you might call A matters in our day, either personnel and the sort of standards and disciplines and what have you. Or they wrote my confidential report. We, of course, were not invited to the Falkland War. The Royal Navy had no idea who we were or what our capability was. And so when we hadn't been invited, I called Julian Thompson, telephoned him down in Plymouth, and I'd worked with him a lot. He was the designated land force commander with three commander brigades with the deployed force for the Falkland War. I rang him up and said, hey, I think you're going to need us. He said, aren't you on the all bad? I said, no, we're not. He said, you better come down. I'll give you 12 places on HMS Fearless, my command ship. And I'm having a conference this afternoon, a planning conference, which you better come down for. So we were woven in. We wove ourselves in at that particular point into the war, into the Falkland Island War. We managed to get a squadron because it was chaos in the Ministry of Defence at the time. And as John Knott said, the minute Whitehall was caught with its pants down, and in the sort of confusion, we had a very good air liaison officer in the Ministry of Defence who was able to get D squadron onto two VC-10s to Ascension Island. Of course, once they were out there, there was no way they were going to come back. And of course, they went on to do great things, you know, helping with the liberation of South Georgia and then going on, of course, and destroying all those Pukara on Pebble Island, you know, tremendous achievement throughout the war. Meanwhile, I was working with Julian Thompson in a sort of open way because, of course, it was very unusual for the SS to be working as sort of part of the Green Army, not covert, not clandestine, but actually open. And so we managed, you know, because we were there 3 weeks before everybody else, deployed by the helicopters of 846 Naval Air Squadron. I've been at school with Air Squadron Commander Simon Thornewell, and so we were able to get the helicopter support we needed through, again, back channel means. We managed to get our soldiers ahead of everybody else onto the, and produce all the intelligence about the whereabouts of the Argentines, their morale, their strengths, their capabilities, all the things on which were needed to plan for the post landing. The landing and the post-landing operation. And that's what we did. Meanwhile, Peter de la Billia, my due date of appointment was up, and I was due to be pasted, I think, on the 1st of June, out of command of 22 SAS. So Peter de Billia said, well, I've got, of course, another Coldstream was replacing me in Neville Hyde. And I said, there's no way I'm going to leave my soldiers in the middle of a war, so I'm not going to come back. He said, I'm giving you a direct order. So you give me as many direct orders as you like. I'm not coming back. And I didn't. I didn't come back till the day the war ended.
What did he say when you got back about that?
I think we avoided the subject for quite a while. No, he and I are very good friends. I saw him the other day. He's in good form.
When you were commanding the SAS in the 1980s, you could almost sort of argue this was a somewhat of a golden era for the Army, in that we had success after success. What do you think the key features of the country's leadership and the Army's generalship were at the time that made it so robust?
And I think we go back to giving people more leeway than maybe they've got today. There was a lot of leeway given to people in our day. Whether it was the golden period, probably was. I mean, when I joined the Army was 240,000 strong. We circled the globe. We had more terrain in Singapore than the Singaporeans owned, the armed forces did. You know, that was a glorious age in my book, particularly as a post-imperial child of the British Empire myself.
And of course, all this was achieved without the mobile phone or the internet. In 1994, you took over command of the United Nations Protection Force in Bosnia, commanding over 39,000 men from all manner of diverse nations such as Argentina to Malaysia to us, the Coldstream Battalion would warrior in Bosnia at the time. How did you find working for a French general?
Well, I got on with him famously well. I mean, fortunately, because I'd lived in Paris and then had been subsequently working in a French school down in Vizille, which is near Grenoble, for another year, I was actually, you know, could speak French and think like the French. That was the most important thing. And the French officers, I have to say, were extremely good. And, all the French spoke, young officers spoke fluent English. They were extremely capable. They took risks and chances where one should. I think we were more reserved in our approach, I think. Although I have to say, the coaching did a very, very good job in Sarajevo when they bust into Sarajevo and calmed down one particular sector.
You arrived there and put Unprofor on the forward foot, where previously it had been on the back foot.
When I arrived, the thing was a sham, because it was a collapsing mission. Boutros Ghali was threatening to withdraw it in the spring. I arrived in January. The troop contributing nations, 16 at the time, were all threatening to pull their troops out because the costs and the casualties and the weren't worth the product on the ground, which was supposed to be producing humanitarian aid for the 2.7 million people of Bosnia who were dependent upon it. And so we just threw the whole previous file away and started a fresh book, as it were. I went to see Kofi Annan in New York and said to him, look, there are three parts to this mission. One is to deliver humanitarian aid. Second is to try and bring about the conditions in which there could be political resolution. And third is to stop the war spreading. And at that time, if you remember, there's a lot of talk about lift and strike. I said, there's going to be no lift and strike. You can't do lift and strike and peacekeeping at the same time. And so we went through all this in New York with the troop contributing nations, with the Americans who attended the meetings, and indeed with the Russians. Lavrov, believe it or not, was attending this meeting. Well, he's still the foreign minister, extraordinary, after all these years, over 25 years. So we got the basics on which that. We then issued a set of orders to everybody. We moved the headquarters from a remote, which was well remote for the center of gravity. It was in Kislyak, an old Olympic headquarters. Mm-hmm. And we moved it into the center of Sarajevo and drove the mission from there. And I created three sectors at sort of brigade level. So we then had, instead of trying to run everything from the center, it was then delegated out, you know, all basic common sense stuff. But the result was a complete transformation of the mission in that aid started to flow again. Oh, by the way, I said every one of our headquarters location will be co-located with the UNHCR, who were responsible for delivering aid. And there was literally just a hatch in a wall that separated the two offices. So if there were problems or something needed to be done, they just could talk to each other immediately. Whereas up till then, they had not talked to each other, you know, common sense things like that. And so in the end, the mission started to, and of course, the young peacekeepers all wanted it to succeed. They didn't want to be part of a failed a mission. And indeed, the whole thing turned around and would have succeeded, and priests would have returned, had it not been for the Americans illegally arming the Muslims, which of course gave them hope of recovering their lost territories by force of arms. An absolutely hopeless ambition, given the fact that they didn't have an army, and you can't create an army in a year. As a result, they turned down the offer of a peace at the end of 94, which was on the table, the Van Zayn peace, fought on for till the end of 95, taking many more casualties. I mean, the awful atrocities happened at Srebrenica, all because the Muslims had been persuaded by the Americans to keep going on the military front, which was ridiculous.
Do you feel that with a smaller, much reduced British army, we can make a meaningful contribution to UN operations in the future?
Well, I think, of course, we can. But I think the British Army, of course, has got a tremendous contribution to make. We've got a very good history of what I call, in the old colonial days, keeping the peace, part three, living and working with indigenous communities, learning their language, eating their food, respecting their customs, and bringing them on side. And I think that's probably, and I know we've got a brigade that does that now in the British Army. We're going training people to try and produce their own security rather than having it imposed from the outside, often at the point of a sword by the Western democratic powers. No, I think we've got a tremendous role to play.
The last victory parade through the City of London was in 1991, following the first Gulf War. Since the beginning of this century, the army has not known success. In Iraq in 2007, it suffered the ignominy of being relieved by the US Army. And indeed, has been criticised as a decade of botched campaigns, most recently in Simon Akam's Changing of the Guard, where he cites a failure of leadership by the generals and not lack of political will as the real cause of the army's problems in the last two decades. What do you think about that?
Well, I think the view from the bottom of the trenches where the last author probably was, is not always the most accurate. I mean, you've got clear blue sky above you, and I'm sure you're very accurate about that, but you can't see the whole picture. First of all, the Iraq War was a terrible disaster. It was a predictable disaster. And I was one of the few retired generals at the time writing, talking, going on TV, debating, arguing against that war, because it was quite obvious. If you were going to impose democracy in Iraq at the point of a sword, you were going to change the whole dynamic of the Middle East, because, of course, the sheer of the majority of people in Iraq, by bringing them into power, which is what we did, you were going to create a problem for the Sunnis, who had driven the Shia out in 1628, I think, when the Ottoman Empire drove the Safavids across out of Baghdad and back into Persia. And of course, by reversing that, we created the very problems we've got today. We should never have got into that war. The original objectives of Operation Enduring Freedom, which is what the operation to kick the Taliban out of Afghanistan was in 2001, was extraordinarily successful, a brilliant operation using the Northern Alliance on the ground, some special forces and US air power. By November, the Taliban had been driven out of Afghanistan. And we then came up with an extremely good strategy, which was to embed ourselves, the special forces, the Americans, the British, the French, and everybody else, embed them with the Pathan tribes along the Afghanistan-Pakistan border, and to do what we basically done in the Dhofar War, take over the irregulars, take over the tribes, live with them permanently, don't come and go, but live with them all the time, and they would produce your best intelligence. So we were in a very good position, building our position with the tribal structures along the border, the Afghan-Pakistan border, when Tony Blair withdrew all the special forces to go and hunt for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. A snare delusion. It was like hunting the snark. And of course, that it broke our trust with the Pathan people, who immediately reverted back to supporting the Taliban. From that moment on, the war was lost in 2003. If we'd kept our position with the Pathan tribes, then the Taliban would never have come back, and we'd have been able to achieve what we nation building that we hoped to achieve. And for Tony Blair to go on TV yesterday and the day before saying, of course, we shouldn't be withdrawing. It was his withdrawal of the troops out of Afghanistan in 2003 that caused the collapse of that mission. And for him, the chief arsonist, going around today, telling everybody how to put out the fire that he himself had started all those years ago.
But nonetheless, history has shown that five times we've tried to go into Afghanistan, five times we've come out with our tail between our legs. Do you join Tony Blair in saying that President Biden's withdrawal actually was imbecilic?
No, absolutely not. I mean, but the war was lost after 2003, and we lost it because of his action withdrawing the troops out of Afghanistan at that particular time. And there was a complete difference. People make this too easy a comparison between the British being driven out of Afghanistan three times in the 19th century. But of course, we were there as occupiers. When we went in 2001, we were there working for and alongside the Afghan people to get the Taliban out of that country. We were not the occupiers. We were the people, we were the facilitators for the Afghan people. We were pouring an awful lot of money for reconstruction. They all understood that. And it was us betraying them, broke our promises by legging it off to Iraq that caused the beginning of the end. And of course, for Tony Blair to say that, as I say, it's like the chief arsonist going around advising people to put out the fire that he himself had started in the first place.
The reality is, however, is that we cannot do this without the Americans, without the presence of the Americans. Presumably, therefore, Prime Minister Johnson's going to have to redraw his plans for global Britain, because we actually need to have greater funds put on defence, because you can no longer rely on the Americans to do anything or to work in tandem with us. Is that fair to say?
I think we're going to always have to work with the Americans. I mean, you know, for good or for bad, going through the rough patches with the smooth patches, we're always going to have to work with the Americans. They are the global superpower. They have technology which we or the Europeans will never be able to match. And of course, it's a combination of technology and people that's going to win wars in the future. And I think Biden was quite right to say we should withdraw at some point. And we gave Trump, actually, he's merely following Trump's edict that they would withdraw. He did a deal with the Taliban, and we've just kept that motion going.
The wider issue is that it is not fair on Americans to assume that they will police the world where our NATO partners and ourselves included should be in a situation whereby we can put together some form of coalition so the Americans can walk away and we could have carried on, which we can't do at the moment.
I mean, Madeleine Albright, after the Balkan War, said that who was the Secretary of State, as you know, said that the America cannot be the world's policeman on its own. It has to work through coalitions, either the United Nations, NATO, or coalitions of the willing. And that's what America's been doing. The fact that it's been undermined, its efforts have been undermined by poor political decisions, it doesn't mean to say that the basic principle isn't right.
Among our listeners, there will be many veterans of the Afghan campaign. With your experience and background, what do you say to them as they see 20 years of hard effort and in many cases, sacrifice and injury, now looking back on this 20 years?
Well, I think they can look back on what they achieved with an enormous pride. I mean, terrible sacrifices people made, death and injury, being away from home for those long and protracted periods of time. I mean, they were able to do more or less what they were asked to do at the tactical level. The fact that the thing didn't work at the strategic level was more down to the corruption of the Afghan government and the rulers in Kabul, and the blind eye that our politicians and statesmen turned to that corruption, knowing perfectly well it was happening, and ignoring the negative effect it would have on the Afghan people, who could see their money being stolen and sent abroad. That takes nothing away from the extraordinary achievements of our soldiers on the ground, and indeed the civil servants who work there, and also the NGOs. And of course, the NGOs will continue there. But I'm sure in the long run, what we've put into Afghanistan will pay rewards at some point in the future.
You've had a remarkable career. Looking back over all those times, from the Falklands War to the Iranian embassy to Bosnia to Northern Ireland and the Troubles, what for you is the highlight?
And I was lucky enough to serve with some brilliant soldiers throughout my career, whether it been in the Coldstream with the SAS or even working with the United Nations, some extraordinary people. And many of those people still remain very good friends of mine today, whether they be corporals or whether they be generals. And Napoleon and I once said, I need, I don't need necessarily well-trained generals, I just need lucky generals. And I regard myself as being a very lucky general.
We are very lucky to have had you on the programme. General Sir Michael Rose, thank you very much for being my guest on General Talk. Thank you.
Not at all.
And my thanks to General Sir Michael Rose for being this month's guest on General Talk. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, would like to learn more about the work of the Soldiers' Charity or to take part in its many events, please visit soldierscharity.org. From me, Harry Bucknell, farewell and thank you for listening. With editing by Michael Stiglianu, this podcast has been a Gamekeeper production for ABF, the Soldiers' Charity.